Yeah. All right. Well, thanks, Bob. Again, we appreciate you coming in.
Thanks, Prevention on Point.
Thank you, Bob. We've had Bob Hoyt here, the director of Greener Pathways Mobile Outreach. Thank you, Tara. Thanks for taking time to talk.
Hey, what's happening?
Brother, what's up?
This is a groovy
party, man.
There's nothing the country cured with a wink and a fart, and you're listening to WGXC in Accra, 90.7 FM.
Hey, I'm Spike Priggin, host of the Bedazzled Radio Hour. Broadcast every week from 12:10 until 2 p.m. Wednesday afternoon, live from Spike's Record Rack, 400 Main Street in the Village of Catskill. Every Wednesday, I play pop, rock, soul, country, blues, reggae, and other obscurities, and once in a while, a hit or two. Please check out the Bedazzled Radio Hour with Spike Priggin on WGXE 90.7 FM, Accra, every Wednesday from 12:10 until 2.
WGXE underwriting is provided in part by Upstate Films, a nonprofit theater connecting the Hudson Valley through transformative cinematic experiences in both Rhinebeck and Saugerties, and now opening this month, Upstate Midtown in Kingston. The grand opening celebration on September 19th, 20th, and 21st features screenings of Orwell, 2 plus 2 equals 5, A Strange Journey, The Story of Rocky Horror, and Linda, Linda, Linda. Information and tickets at upstatefilms.org.
Wave Farms WGXC is made possible in part by the generous support Melinda of Catskill, New York. WGXC supporters care deeply about creative community radio. Their generosity and investment keep this unique station viable. You too can become a monthly supporter by going to wgxc.org/donate and establishing a donation at the amount of your choosing. We hope you will do so. Thank you so much for your support.
Hello and welcome to the better weather for Friday, September 5th. Local early morning temperatures range from 55 degrees in Medusa to 64 in most of the valley. Regional average soil temperature is 65 degrees. Air quality will be good, pollen levels will be low. Some rain early today leaves things wet this morning. Everything should be nice and dry by this afternoon due to sunny skies and some low-end wind gusts. We get a high of 82 at 5 p.m. Overnight, temperatures dip to 65 degrees. Dew points will be very close, so it may feel quite humid. Tomorrow, rain expected all day long. It will be the strongest in the morning. We get a high temperature of 76 at 1 p.m. Overnight, we get more rain and a low of 56. Sunday, rain stops in the morning, skies brighten up, and we get a high of 72 at 4 p.m. Monday will probably be dry with a high of 70 degrees. Today's tide schedule is high tide at 1:31 a.m., low tide at 8:20 a.m., high tide again at 2:04 p.m., then low tide once again at 8:22 p.m. Today's river temperature will be 75 degrees and the tide strength will be high. Sunset today will be at 7:11 p.m., sunrise tomorrow will be at 6:21 a.m. Just a reminder, folks, those numbers are adjusted for the mountain ranges that do affect our sunsets. Looking way up, we see X-class flare chances are at 10%. Plasma winds will be average at 429 kilometers per second with a thin density of 1 proton per cubic centimeter. Radio propagation conditions are currently pretty normal with an S1 level noise floor. There are no chances of aurora this evening, but they could be around over Saturday as we dip into that plasma ribbon. The current sunspot number is 150, and this has been The Better Weather, brought to you by the Catskill Makers Syndicate.
Public News Service Friday afternoon update. I'm Mike Clifford. Republican senators are sending clear signals of disapproval and unhappiness with Secretary of Health and Human Services Robert F. Kennedy Jr. making it plain to President Trump they want the administration to address the chaos that Kennedy has caused by trying to rewrite the nation's vaccine policies. That's the take from The Hill. They report GOP senators have stopped short of calling on Kennedy to resign, but they want him to back off efforts to change vaccine policy recommendations without sound scientific backing. And from the BBC, U.S. immigration authorities have raided a massive Hyundai manufacturing site in Georgia, leading to the arrest of over 450 people. Korean nationals were among those detained, the South Korean Foreign Ministry said, calling it an unjust infringement on their rights. Meantime, Grand Teton National Park will host a congressional hearing today on renewed funding for a law that provides for maintenance on public lands.
The Great American Outdoors Act, which passed with bipartisan support during the first Trump administration, is now up for reauthorization. Emily Dells with the National Parks Conservation Association says the law has funneled more than $6.5 billion to national parks to fix a range of issues.
A lot of these facilities, whether it's a visitor center or waste or drinking water systems or trails or campgrounds, you know, they were built 60 years ago and they need an upgrade.
I'm Suzanne Potter.
And a data center company hopes to break ground soon on a new project for North Dakota with promises of economic gains. But in addition to community level pushback, the proposal faces questions about sustainability.
The firm behind the project, Applied Digital, wants to build a $3 billion data center just outside Fargo. Officials say it's needed to meet the surge in demand for storing digital data while touting at least 200 jobs for the local area. Michael Grollum with the Dakota Resource Council says this area already is growing, and he questions whether it's worth it to use land protected by the flood mitigation effort known as the Red River Diversion.
Especially in Fargo, it's just such a waste of land that we've worked so hard to make viable. And we're just going to throw it away for a data center, and it's fairly frustrating.
I'm Mike Moen.
Next to New York, where advocates are joining national groups to file an international legal complaint against the U.S. government for its use of American taxpayer dollars on the Israel-Palestine war. Afaf Nasher with the New York chapter of the Council of American Islamic Relations says Americans are upset their money is going towards something they don't support.
The majority of Americans are upset, frustrated, and enraged over the continued tax money that's going abroad instead of utilized properly for Americans here. And of course, the anguish that goes along with the ongoing genocide.
The complaint is being filed with the human rights arm of the Organization of American States. This is a public news service. Cuts to the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, or SNAP, are raising alarms in Georgia, where high poverty rates and limited grocery access already make it difficult for families to eat well.
According to a report by KFF Health News, the cuts also counter efforts to help people fight chronic illnesses through healthy food. Gina Platanino with the Food Research and Action Center says the reductions come as residents pay more for food, rent, and other essentials. She explains the loss of support won't just hurt households, but could ripple through rural towns and local economies.
As these cuts keep coming through, basic services or even K-12 education are going to be put at risk because there are no resources coming in, but the need will still be there and prices of food will keep increasing and shelter costs and everything will be there.
She cautions that families will feel the squeeze first, but the impact won't stop there. Shantia Hudson reporting. This story was produced with original reporting from Renuka Reyesam for KFF Health News.
And scams involving false claims for medical equipment are spreading across Ohio. That's according to experts in Medicare fraud.
Sometimes scammers offer free equipment in exchange for your Medicare number, even if you don't need it. They bill Medicare and potentially get paid. Carolina Eiler, a program specialist who works with seniors on Medicare counseling and fraud prevention, says this not only drains money from the Medicare program, but people can be denied the equipment in the future.
When they actually need the device and the doctor orders it, the supplier is going to try to bill Medicare. Medicare is going to deny the claim because there's already a claim for the same thing that was billed.
The FBI reports that in 2023, older Ohioans lost more than $64 million to fraud and scams. Farah Siddiqui reporting.
Finally, conservation groups in New England are urging the public to comment on the Trump administration's proposed repeal of the federal roadless rule.
If redacted, roughly 260,000 acres of pristine wilderness within the region's White Mountain and Green Mountain National Forests could be open to commercial logging. Matt Cannon with the Sierra Club Maine says Americans have less than 3 weeks to weigh in on the decades-old policy.
This seems like the process is being purposefully accelerated in a way to meet the administration's ends, and that's something we should all be very, very concerned about.
The Trump administration argues the rule's repeal is needed to increase American timber production by 25% and allow for more oil and gas drilling on federal lands. The public comment period runs through September 19th. I'm Catherine Carley.
Cannon says roadless areas not only drive tourism in parts of New England, but also provide critical wildlife habitat. This is Mike Clifford for Public News Service, member and listener supported. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
Welcome to the WGXC Afternoon Show. I'm your host, Lucy. I am all set up in the window of the WGXC Catskill Studio at 393 Main Street. So if you're around, pop by and give me a little wave. I'm right in the window. It also happens to be First Friday here in Catskill. There's a lot going on Main Street. There's actually a ribbon cutting for the new community theater that's going on as we speak. I think it was 4 to 8. There's a lot going on. Restaurants are open, stores are open, art shows, ribbon cuttings. So if you're around, come hang out on Main Street. Give Catskill a look. Today in the studio, I have Adam Weiner with me. Welcome, Adam.
Hello. Great to be here.
Adam is the new executive director for the Hudson Hall across the river in Hudson. And a couple of details first. We have so much to talk about, but before we dive into all of that, I wanted to give our listeners some details about Hudson Hall, about some events that you have coming up. If you wanted to get more information, it's hudsonhall.org. On the hudsonhall.org, you'll find a calendar of events, a history of the building, the community programs, all sorts of information. So again, that's hudsonhall.org. And I was looking through the fantastic calendar of events before our interview. And one in particular stuck out to me. Natalie Merchant will be there in November.
That's right.
That's crazy. And anybody who's in maybe my age bracket, the 40-somethings, can remember her fantastic, the video of her doing Patti Smith's Because the Night
with the
10,000 Maniacs. I'm sure that's going to be amazing. But yeah, that's in November. That information is all on the website. There are so many things. There are art shows there. It's not just performances, but you have film screenings, concerts. I've been to concerts there before. Art shows, like I said. And then a huge one coming up is the Hudson Jazz Festival.
That's right. That opens October 3rd, runs through October 5th. I believe it's our fifth season of the Jazz Fest.
Wow.
Really fun time. And yeah, I encourage you to come check us out. It is Hudson's oldest surviving theater, so quite a history to learn about. And we're open 6 days a week. Our art gallery, you can come and come say hello. The exhibit up right now is by Christian Markley. It's a beautiful exhibit. And yeah, we're gearing up for our next concert. It features Moom, the Icelandic group, which you might remember from their previous U.S. tours. It's been a minute since they've been in the U.S., but we're excited to have them. And then, yeah, the Hudson Jazz Festival, which takes place at Hudson Hall, but also locations all over the city of Hudson. So it's a really nice kind of festival feeling.
Yeah, that's awesome. Yeah, to bring in the entire town, village, city, whatever you want to call it. there are so many things. There was a photographer who I know from Foreland. She has a studio there, Corinne Botts. She has some artwork coming up in October. So yeah, there's a little something for everybody. And if you're local, like I said, there's community programs that are fantastic. Yeah, Hudson Hall, just an awesome, awesome little thing there. And you actually, as I was doing my research, you're the new executive director, but you are not new to the Hudson Hall you have a history with the city and the hall. So tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, that's right. Stepping into this role feels in one way like a return and another way like a step forward for me. I did a residency at Hudson Hall back in 2014.
As a dancer.
As a dancer, yes. I was working on a new creation, which later went on to premiere at the Jacob's Pillow Dance Festival in the Berkshires, and then went to Lincoln Center down in Manhattan.
Wow.
So I've seen how that space can really lift up local talent and put it on the national stage. And that's what I hope to continue to do in this new role as executive director.
Yeah, that's fantastic. And I wanted to talk about, you brought up Jacob's Pillow, which again, as I was doing research for our interview, I'm embarrassed to say that I had no idea what it was.
Oh,
I
cool.
had no idea that 1 hour from our little town, our little village, our valley here in Beckett, Massachusetts, is something that Baryshnikov himself called one of America's most precious cultural assets. I had no idea. So for us Philistines who apparently don't know what's going on, tell us a little bit about Jacob's Pillow, and then we'll go into, because you have your own thing going on there. But in general, give us a little overview of the amazing Jacob's Pillow.
Sure. So Jacob's Pillow was founded over 90 years ago. It's America's longest running dance festival, and one of the longest running in the world. And it offers, they have a 10-ish week summer festival, which includes performances on 3 different stages. They also have summer classes and year-round programming and artist residencies. So for dancers, it really is a hallowed ground.
Yeah. Yeah. As I was reading about it, I was, like I said, I was just shocked that that's an hour from here. I mean, I think that that's one of the most amazing things about this area is that you can be technically in the middle of nowhere. And I feel like I'm allowed to say that because I'm from here. I can say whatever I want. Yeah, you're in the middle of nowhere in this beautiful, you know, bucolic setting. And then you have access to things like that.
Mm-hmm.
That's crazy. So, you know, anybody that's never heard of Jacob's Pillow, go check it out. I just went into a deep dive into their fantastic website. Yeah, I mean, you know, I'm not somebody, I'm a visual artist, so I don't know much about dance, but it's obviously always intrigued me because it's still a visual medium. And yeah, it just seemed really fantastic. And they have a school there. They have other community programs. I love when artistic ventures have these community programs too. Don't forget your community. So yeah, it's fantastic. So you started in 2020 something on the campus of Jacob's Pillow called Jacob's Garden.
That's right. Yeah, which is maybe a micro farm is one way of describing it. We grow food which serves the dancers and patrons who dine on campus, because
nice.
The Pillow has 4 on-campus restaurants, including the cafeteria that feeds the artists.
And so they have residencies and the school.
That's right. Yeah. So they usually have at least 3 companies in residence at a time, as well as students from whatever program is running at that moment, which might be ballet or jazz or modern or what have you. And I really drew inspiration from the founding dance company that started Jacob's Pillow, which was this all-male dance company in the 1930s. And they grew all of their own food, and they built their own dance studios and their own housing. And that was an important part of their physical training and also their creative process. And then it was also very practical because this was the Great Depression and they needed that food.
Yeah.
And I really liked that that combination of, you know, idealism and practicality. And in the pandemic, they gave me the opportunity to renew the practice of agriculture on the campus because it had fallen away, I think, at some point in the 1970s. And it was a really fun process. You know, to be honest, I didn't know that it would impact my dancing in a meaningful way, but I found that it really did. I did some training. I grew up in Manhattan, so what I didn't know about how food grows could fill this studio. And I remember I said to the field manager where I was apprenticing before I started the farm, like, oh, you know, farm work is so surprising. I thought it was going to be so repetitive, but we come in and we do something totally different every day. And he said, well, it is repetitive. It just operates on a cycle.
And you haven't been to the other side of the cycle yet.
And it blew my mind, and it totally changed my sense of space and time and a sense of groundedness in my dancing. So it ended up being this transformative thing. And
also patience. There's so many things. You know, I lacked that. I know how to have a garden. I don't do it. I say I'm very good at going to the farmer's market. But yeah, and it also seems like it would be super important. As a dancer, you're such an athlete as well. So, you know, the food that you're eating is so, you know, nourishing, and food is so important to any athlete.
Yes. And it's also a nice touch point with community. We got a nice group of volunteers, mostly, you know, little old biddies from the Berkshires, and also students. And we donate about 25% of what we grow to local food pantries.
Oh, nice.
So it's also been a really nice kind of vector.
Yeah. 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 And a way to incorporate the community again. I love that. So it's the micro farm, but there are also performances around the space.
We've had performances there, and it's grown to include a small apple orchard.
Oh,
and
nice.
We keep bees there now. I'd say half the space is dedicated to annual crops, like mostly lettuce and radish and cucumbers, like salad-y things. But then we also have a bed of herbs we grow for a dried tea blend. And then my favorite might be the arnica that we grow. Because arnica is a medicinal plant that dancers use to treat injuries.
Oh, wow.
Like minor bruises, sprains, things like that. Not just dancers, but it's very popular in dance. And so this year we've harvested them, and we're turning it into a salve.
Oh, wow.
That will be available in the gift shop.
That's really cool. Yeah, that's awesome. Again, if anybody hasn't heard of Jacob's Pillow, or the Jacob's Garden website is Jacob's Garden, J-A-C-O-B-S garden.org. And there's also jacobspillow.org. Check both of those out. And yeah, I want to dive in. You said you're from Manhattan. I want to dive into that a little bit. So you have a very impressive educational resume and resume in general. So how did you go from Manhattan? How did you find yourself here in Hudson? Was it the residency first, or?
Well, great question. Right. So I grew up in Manhattan. I danced from a very young age, but I never really considered it like a professional pathway.
Oh, interesting.
Until I was actually an economics major at Vassar College.
Wow.
My parents are economists, so that kind of tracks.
Wait, did they push you to that, or were you just like, you? Because I think it's funny that kids just sometimes accept things that they see around them.
Yeah, I was like, I know the lingo, you know, I can do
You're
this.
Like, numbers and stuff. So did you just accept it, or did they push you to that? Or you were just like, this is what I do now?
Well, I think I'll answer that by saying the summer after my freshman year,
In college or in?
In college.
So you were well on that track.
I was well on that track. I enrolled in the summer school at Jacob's Pillow.
Oh, okay.
And it just totally transformed my idea of, you know, what dance is, what dance can be. I was totally thrilled by it. And it felt like something I could bring my whole self to, which I didn't, and I didn't feel the same way about economics.
Yes. Which some people maybe do, and that's awesome. That's awesome for them.
That's right.
That's really interesting that you, what was it that you thought wouldn't be, you know, a lifelong track in dance for you as a career? Why? Because I would think that, I find that interesting because having grown up, as I mentioned earlier, around here, it never occurred to me that you could be an artist because I didn't see that.
Yeah.
So it's interesting to me that you, and that was, I think, really the only reason was just it wasn't something I saw. There weren't museums. There weren't any of these things in the 80s happening around here. So it wasn't until later and I saw that you, that was a real thing that I was like, oh, this is what I want to do. So you having grown up in Manhattan around culture, I mean, there's culture on every corner. What was it, do you think, that made you think it wasn't viable?
Well, when I was a child, I studied at the School of American Ballet. And that is how I came to define what dance was. And that path did not appeal to me.
Okay. So you knew it was possible. You just were like, no, thank you.
Yeah. You know, and we can get into my ballet baggage another time.
That's a whole different episode.
But, you know, when I was at Jacob's Pillow, we studied the work of the choreographer, Pina Bausch, who is this incredible choreographer. And it just introduced me to a whole new world. And I thought, wow, here's something that is challenging me physically, intellectually, as a performer, emotionally. I was like, wow, this is exciting. And I decided that if I wanted to dance, I needed to do it now. I could come back to economics later if
there
needed.
There will always be numbers.
And so I decided that I was going to audition for conservatories. And it was funny because I never imagined that I would get into Juilliard. It was literally practice because I hadn't been to a dance audition in 10 plus years.
Wow.
And it was the closest one.
Like, let's
it was
like, do
it's down
it.
The street. I'm just going to go.
I love that. Let's see how this goes.
And you know, my parents were not thrilled at first, I'll be honest. Oh. But the Juilliard thing kind of turned them around.
Yeah, I would think so. They're like, all right, maybe. Well, that's awesome. Yeah. And you made it in.
I made it in.
All the way through.
And that was the learning curve there felt also very extreme because I had not been in a conservatory kind of environment, but it was very exciting. And I started dancing professionally my senior year. I was lucky to get some really great touring opportunities. I was really interested in choreography, so I wanted to work with working choreographers rather than a repertory company, for example.
Which is for all of our listeners that don't know.
Yeah, so I guess the difference is you're either working with someone who's creating new works on you and with you, or you join a company and you learn all the dances that they do, which might be a Nutcracker and something else.
Yes.
Something else.
Oh, okay.
So you're
okay.
You're a part of the creative process.
So that's a repertory.
Yes. Yeah. Good.
I see. So they're putting on other people's shows, and when you work with a choreographer, they're creating their own pieces with you.
Yes. Got
it.
I wanted to know, you know, how the sausage is made.
Yeah.
So I got in there.
And what is your particular style of dance? So you didn't want to do the ballet. That was thrown out with the economics.
Yeah, I did a number of different styles. You know, I was dancing with the Mark Morris Dance Group, which is very kind of American modern dance. I also danced for a Chinese choreographer named Shen Wei for a number of years, with a very different style, but we got to tour all over Asia, which is very exciting.
Yeah.
So I had a nice mix in there. And eventually I started focusing on creating my own work. And that's in a way how I wound up here in Hudson. you know, my husband, who is an opera director, and I, we both
equally as awesome and interesting.
You know, we both realized that, hey, you know, we both travel for work primarily these days. I mean, I was on the road 35, 40 weeks a year.
Wow.
That we don't need to be based in New York City anymore, and actually we can't really afford it. So
yeah.
let's find somewhere else. And, you know, I'd been to Hudson a few times for dance residencies, and he had friends from college who were living here. And it's a groovy community.
Yeah.
With a lot of spaces where, you know, artistic practices can happen.
Yeah.
Including Hudson Hall.
Yeah.
And I was very lucky that, you know, in the first year I moved here, I connected with the hall, and they offered me a residency, which, you know, at that time, it was before the theater had been refinished.
Mm-hmm.
So it was just this big, raw space. There was one working electrical outlet.
Oh my goodness.
No lights.
Oh.
But you know, then she gave me a broom and a boombox and just said, you know, like, go for it.
Do your thing.
Yeah.
That's awesome. Yeah, I feel like that's a very inspirational environment though.
Totally.
You know, just to be in that. And this is a very inspirational area. I always say that having grown up here and having left, I never thought I would come back. But it is so unique. It's so unique for those kinds of reasons.
Yeah.
You know, that you can, you know, come from any background and end up here and find your way. So you did so that was the residency, your broom and the one electrical outlet.
Yeah, and that grew into, like I said, an evening-length work, which premiered at Jacob's Pillow and then went to Lincoln Center and had some other touring and down in Florida. And so I've seen the kind of resource that Hudson Hall can be and what that kind of trust can yield.
Yeah.
And so I feel it's now my turn to pay that forward.
Yeah, that's awesome. That's really cool. So again, I wanted to let our listeners know, if you wanted to find more information about the events at Hudson Hall, it's hudsonhall.org, correct? Yes, hudsonhall.org. And there you'll find, like I said, there's a history of the building. There's the community events. If you're local, there's kids classes.
That's right.
Kids programming. There's all sorts of awesome things. You'll find the events calendar. The jazz festival's coming up. Just a ton of stuff. So that's hudsonhall.org. And then also, if you're interested in finding out more about Jacob's Pillow, which is also very interesting, jacobspillow.org and jacobsgarden.org. Mm-hmm. So if you want to find out information, go check it out there. So we have, oh my goodness, we have a half an hour left.
Cool.
And we've come to the part of the show where I look at the book of questions from Gregory Stock, PhD.
Uh-oh.
It's a very silly book. It claims to be a New York Times bestseller. They're very serious questions, but they're very silly questions. They're not supposed to be silly, but they are. So I have a couple marked, but I'm just going to open at random.
Okay.
And we're going to go from there.
I'm a little scared.
You should be. they're, again, you can be as funny as you want, or you can answer them seriously. It's up to you. If you could somehow protect your loved ones from pain and failure, do you think they might ultimately end up diminished by your efforts?
Hmm. You know, I'd say so.
I think that's a good answer. some of them don't have any follow up. No, I agree with you. Why don't you go into why you think that would be?
Well, I remember reading about a term. So, you know, we've all heard of helicopter parenting.
Yep.
But then there was also, I think it was it. Bulldozer parenting.
Oh. That could be.
Where you just kind of bulldoze a path for your child, which doesn't serve them in the end.
No.
Was the point of
yes.
that. I think it was a New Yorker article.
Yeah.
It sounds like a New Yorker article.
<It does.
laughs> also maybe reminds me a little bit of of what AI may be doing these days.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, we need to be thinking critically. We need to be
problem solving.
Yeah, dealing with uncomfortable situations.
Yeah. 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 No, good answer. Yeah. I remember reading something once too that said for everything you, I know I keep going back to children, but everything you give your child, you're actually taking something away.
Oh, interesting.
So it's, you know, it was some sociological study or something on parents who grew up, you know, in a lower economic bracket and then managed to, you know, work hard and move their way up. And then they were giving their children everything they didn't have. And then finding out that the children lacked any kind of resiliency. Hmm. So, yeah, I mean, I guess, all right, hopefully the next one's more fun. Sometimes we get serious. Oh, okay. Amnesia comes in two forms. I don't know if that's true or not, but this guy, Gregory Stock, PhD, does.
Okay.
One in which you lose your memory of past events. Another one in which you no longer form new memories. If you took a bad fall and were to suffer one or the other, which would be worse?
Yeah, it reminds me of a Anne Carson quote, who's one of my favorite writers, where she said, to truly forget something, you have to forget you've forgotten it.
Oh, yeah, That makes sense.
And so, you know, I don't think I'd be bothered by not remembering what I don't remember.
That's true. We just made that question moot. Sorry, Gregory Stock, PhD. This one is a revised and updated version. You're going to have to revise that one.
Well, can I? It also makes me think. So, one thing that's really special about Jacob's Pillow is the archive, because dance is notoriously difficult to, you know, notate or preserve. You know, it's such an ethereal thing. It happens while it's happening, and then it's over.
And then it's over.
Yeah. And a lot of choreographers take very different approaches to legacy. You know, sometimes there's a foundation that preserves it. There's one choreographer in Europe who's decided that, he's probably the most famous living choreographer, but he's decided that when he dies, no one's allowed to perform his work ever again. Which frustrates, you know, companies who purchase his work for hundreds of thousands of dollars, because he could be hit by a bus tomorrow.
And you're done.
Yeah.
That's interesting. I didn't think of that. Yeah.
But there's one choreographer who has created, every year he makes two works, one to be performed and one to be documented to premiere posthumously after he dies. And he was interviewed.
Wait, they're separate?
Right.
Oh, so one is a mystery.
One is a mystery.
Wow.
It's, you know, they have costumes, they have music, they have scenography. The dancers learn it.
Wow.
But they don't perform it until sometime TBD.
Wait, they don't even perform it?
No.
So it's just in their heads?
They've recorded it on camera.
Okay.
And they document
but
it.
So they have done it. They know it. But no, the public has not seen it.
Right.
Wow. That's cool, though.
And I remember he was interviewed, and the interviewer asked him, well, what if it's not done to your satisfaction or to your liking or to your specifications? Like, how will you can't monitor that.
Yeah.
And his answer was, what do I care? I'll be dead.
Yes, exactly. That's on you. Oh my, that's really interesting. What was his name again?
His name is Mark Morris.
That's awesome. That's a cool idea. I guess I had a question about that too while you were talking. How is choreography written?
Mm-hmm.
Like the instructions.
Yeah. There have been different techniques. For a long time, there was a notation form called Laban notation, sort of like a musical score.
Oh, okay.
But it's very complicated to read, and almost nobody knows how to read it anymore.
Mm-hmm.
When film came around, it sort of outmoded this notation form, and it's like almost a dead language now. But dance is traditionally taught more like an oral history. So, you know, you learn it from someone who learned it from someone who learned it from the choreographer.
Mm-hmm.
When I was working on this Jacob's Pillow project, I did put together some of the dances that the original dancers created, which was a strange process because they mostly, there's none of them are living today.
Mm-hmm.
It was an all-male dance company. They all fought in World War II, and they mostly didn't come back
Wow.
from that war. So I didn't have a bloodline connecting me to those works. So it was this strange process of using memoir and photograph and some film footage and rumor, like really whatever I could get my hands on.
Yeah.
And the farm, that's kind of how the farm work started, is because it felt like a way for me to connect physically to how they operated. Because it was a part of their daily training regimen, along with a technique class, which I reconstructed, and 2 hours of nude sunbathing.
Oh, of course. Obviously. You got to look good in your costume. Yeah, that's really interesting. I that never occurred to me of the archiving of dance. I mean, it is, you know, with music, of course, there's recording. Recording's been around for forever. There's, you know, writing the music down. Yeah, that's crazy that it's like an oral history.
And it was especially fun working on that project at Hudson Hall, at the Hudson Opera House, because you know, I was putting together these old works in this very historic space. You know, it felt like I was dancing with ghosts.
Yeah.
Yeah,
yeah, I could see that. That's really interesting. And when I had another question too, this just kind of keeps leading to other questions. when you are choreographing your own work, mm-hmm. just you personally, where's the music coming from? Do you work with musicians? Do you find a piece that speaks to you? How does that work? Or is it just a little bit of all of that?
Yeah, no, I love that question. You know, my dad, who loves music, can't comprehend that a dance might come before the music, mm-hmm. or without the music.
Mm-hmm.
It just doesn't compute for him.
Yeah.
I was lucky enough to, well, like at Juilliard, for example, they'll often pair you with a composer or a musician, mm-hmm. and that's a really lovely way to work if you have access to something like that.
Yeah.
Up here in Hudson, I collaborated a lot with the artist Chris Garneau, who is a musician and composer, and that was really precious.
So you were collaborating like completely together, so you would come up with the ideas at the same time, or one of you would say, "Oh, I have this movement. Oh, I have this line, you know, harmony, you know, whatever
yeah,
it is."
Yeah.
So, or were you in the, you know, do you have the same concept for the piece at the beginning? Mm.
Yeah, that's a great question.
Like, I want to write a song about the wind. Great, I want to dance about the wind. You know, how does that come together?
Yeah, you know, we would have conversations. You know, he has a lot of music out there already that mm-hmm. I was, you know, very drawn to. So I kind of, there was trust
yeah.
that what he made would be something I'd be down to dance to.
Yeah.
And then a lot happens in the room, and there's something maybe alchemical about it. You know, it's hard to say what comes first. But he was a total joy to work with. And I think different choreographers will give you different answers.
Yes, I figured.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, that's really cool. I love the idea of having a dancer and a musician with an instrument in a room. Like, that just seems like I'd like to be a fly on the wall for that. yeah, because it has to be collaborative. That's what I think is so interesting. As a visual artist, there's not a lot of collaboration. And I was really shocked when I went to college. I thought that I was going to go to art school and be with my people.
Right.
And we would just all talk about art and make art together and whatever. And it's really not a collaborative environment. People don't like to collaborate, at least the ones that I've found.
Hmm.
So, yeah, I mean, the idea of you know, dance. Granted, you can do it by yourself, but it seems like at its core, it's a very collaborative thing, which seems so beautiful for a group of people, whether it's a group of dancers or dancers and musicians or, you know, whatever. To come together and create something all on the same wavelength seems beautiful. Question time.
Okay.
Oh, let's see. What's this one? All right. This one's kind of, I guess, interesting since we're talking about your career. Would you rather be very successful professionally with only a tolerable private life or have a great private life but an uninspiring professional one? Mm. So I guess your professional life is not terrible. It's just uninspiring.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah. Which one?
Well, you know, this reminds me.
No, I love that. That's what we're...
When I was in high school, I was taught that there are three things. Self-care, a social life, and success.
Yes.
And you get two if you're lucky.
Oh.
And I think at that age, I don't think I slept in my 20s.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I think... Sorry, I've sort of lost thread of the question, but I'm just going to keep going with it.
Yeah, do it.
Where, you know, with dance, it was really about the passion. Like, there's no other reason to do it. Like, yeah, you're not going to make money. You're not going to get famous. Like,
yeah. You know? Any creative path is a terrible career choice.
But what's been really exciting is that, you know, where we are up here, it's a place where you can... You can practice what's important to you, mm-hmm. and still exist and do it in community, you know?
Yeah.
And I think that those were two things that were really difficult, like in New York City,
yes.
For example,
yeah.
Where you neither felt like you had a community, or
a successful, or the economics come back in. Yeah. You do the math. I think that with a creative life, it's really difficult to have a creative life without having that kind of social life. I mean, I think it leads you to, you know, an inspiring private life.
And what your observation in the last question about, you know, dance and being in community, like, you know, dance is something that you can't do in a vacuum.
Yeah.
Because you need usually to be doing it with other people.
Yeah.
And you also kind of need someone to be watching.
Yeah, I think that's... It would be a very sad little show. Just dancing in my house. So I think that's a difficult question. Again, if you live... If you, you know, you have kind of this creative life. Then, yeah, you have to be out in the world.
And something that I really love about Hudson Hall in particular is that... So it was originally built as the City Hall for the City of Hudson.
Mm-hmm.
And it had the Common Council Room, it was the jail, it was also the bank, and it was like...
At the same time.
Yeah.
You're like, where do we put the criminals? I don't know, with the money.
In the basement.
In the basement. I love that. Different times.
And, I love that it was so central to civic life in Hudson. I mean,
yeah.
And it had that auditorium where it was the only indoor space where the whole community could gather.
Mm-hmm.
And I really love that organization has continued to strive to be that central to community life in Hudson. Mm-hmm. And it's something that I definitely want to cast out into the future as well.
Yeah. Yeah. No, that's fantastic. All right, we can say that 12 minutes. This is the very first question in Gregory Stock's book of questions.
Okay.
Gregory Stock, PhD. Technology has become a part of us. Mm-hmm. Would you rather lose the use of all motorized vehicles? That's one option. Yes. All telecommunication devices and computers.
Yes.
Or one of your hands.
Oh.
These questions.
Not my hands.
No. It's very easily not my hands. Both of them, I guess. Oh, yeah. No, one of your hands. Oh, you would have one.
Oh, well, I'll keep both. Thank yes. they're good for different things.
So which one do you think you could give up? Vehicles, devices and computers, and clearly not your hands.
Yeah, I'd give up vehicles. No problem.
Yeah, I think that one...
You know, I think that the river that we live near is a great way to get around.
Yeah.
I mean, assuming that you're only going to other places on the river.
Yes. Yeah, you can't go too far. Who needs to go out west there? Yeah, just go up and down the river. You'll be fine. A friend of mine, a fellow photographer, just did a 36-mile kayaking journey up the Hudson.
Wow.
From Athens to Troy.
Wow.
She did it. Shout out to Linda. Yeah. So I don't know if I want to do that, but. Okay. Oh, this one's kind of interesting, especially in this day and age that we're living in.
Okay.
If, without being detected, you could spy electronically for the next month and watch anyone, anywhere, anytime, like a fly on a wall, would you? And if so, who would you watch and how closely?
Oh. Well, that sounds really creepy.
Yes. A little bit. But it kind of feels like that's what's happening. Except we're not spying. People are just offering it.
Yeah. And this might be too much information, but I do like to watch my husband sleep, and he finds that really creepy.
It's like, stop watching me sleep. Just in case anybody wondered, I do not like watching my husband sleep. I do a lot because he snores, and I'm just like, how long until I hit him? But yeah. No, that's sweet, though. I like that.
Yeah, so I'd probably spy on him while he was sleeping.
Oh, that's so cute. Yeah, I mean, honestly, I don't even know who I would choose. I don't think I need, I don't want to know that much. I'm the kind of person that if somebody's diary was sitting on a table in front of me, I literally wouldn't touch it. Because I wouldn't want to know.
Right.
You know what I mean? It's like, I don't know if I would want to do that.
Okay, but have you ever thought that you were on the Truman Show?
Oh, yeah. Absolutely. Yeah, I mean, I think that that's a weird thing. Like I said, because in our day and age, I mean, we were talking about it before we went live on the radio here. Are we muted? You know, it is something like, obviously we're in a radio station, so that's a possibility that we're not muted. But yeah, I mean, I feel like that a lot.
I mean, maybe we are on the Truman Show, actually.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah,
we're not on the Truman Show.
We're not on the Truman Show. And I do feel like anybody could know what we're doing at all times.
Yeah.
I mean, we're live on the radio right now, so you can. we know you're listening, hopefully. Or cameras, or yeah, you just never know. So it is a little weird. But yeah, maybe because of that, I'm like, I just don't want to know what anybody's doing. I don't want them to know what I'm doing. Just leave me alone.
Yeah, there is a beautiful book called In Defense of Opacity, which is sort of taking this idea of visibility and kind of turning it on its head. It's like, actually, there's value in not being visible all the time.
Yeah.
And I didn't read the book.
It was too opaque.
But yeah, I like that idea.
I like that idea, too, because I also, again, I feel like there's, I mean, I'm a little obsessed with, you know, the internet and surveillance and all of these things because I have children. But yeah, I mean, having grown up without those things is a, you know, there's an opacity there where it's like this, you know, the mistakes that you make and the stupid things that you do and say and whatever, they're not recorded for posterity. You know, they're not going to come back to haunt you. And we're right. all idiots. There's that, you know, I'm not excusing, you know, anybody's behavior or whatever, but I feel like at a certain point in time, we all say and do stupid things. So yeah, there is definitely value in, you know, not being seen, not being visible, at certain points in your life, probably throughout your whole life.
Yeah.
Where we just continue to be stupid. Oh my gosh. Yeah. I think I have my memory. Yeah. I remember all the stupid things I've ever said. And yeah, if they were on camera, I'd be very upset.
There's also something really fun and voyeuristic about this setup here yes. in the studio, the sound studio. It's a bustling Friday evening
it
here
is.
In the Village of Catskill? It's a village.
It's a village. It's yep. a village.
But you wouldn't tell from all this foot traffic.
I know.
It's fun. And some people can see that we see them, and some people
Some
can't.
People just don't even care. Yeah. I mean, I think that, you know, Catskill, again, is a really interesting... There's so many different people, you know, that come together in one space. I love it.
Yeah.
I'm definitely a people watcher for sure. And yeah, it can get distracting here in the studio, in the window. We have about 5 minutes.
Okay.
I think that, as we were talking about before, if you do anything creative and you're a dancer, I'm an artist, it's a terrible career choice.
Yep.
You do it for love. You do it for passion. So this is an interesting question.
Okay.
What is so important to you that without it, life wouldn't be worth living? And I say that it doesn't have, your answer doesn't have to be dance, but mm-hmm. You have to be a passionate person to pursue something like that. So I'm sure that there's something that to you, you know, would make life not worth living if you had to lose it. Oh, and there's two questions.
Okay.
Would your answer have been different 10 years ago?
Okay, it's maybe cheesy.
Oh, I'm going to say a cheesy one too, so don't worry.
But the first word that came to mind was joy.
Oh, I love that. Yeah. And would it have been different 10 years ago?
I think so. I think I was in a more... I don't know. More... what's the word? Yeah, I think it would have been different. I don't know what it would have been.
Yeah. I know mine would have been, and I like your answer. I was going to say something maybe like my kids. I don't know. But they bring me joy.
Right.
So, yeah, and I definitely think 10 years ago the answer would have been different, even though, my kids were, well, one of the two was alive 10 years ago. Mm. But, yeah, the pandemic changed me completely, completely changed my priorities. Mm. I probably would have said my job or something like that. But yeah, I think joy is the best answer. I'm going to steal that one. And yeah. And I'm so glad I came to that conclusion. What has it been? 5 years?
We have a kind of a saying in our house that we have a little dog named Bandito, and that he's always right because his priorities are really spot on.
Yeah.
You know, life is about like the things that give you pleasure, being with the ones that you love.
Mm-hmm. Chilling, chilling. That's kids too.
Okay,
I mean,
yeah.
Honestly, that's kids too.
Yeah.
Yeah. They'll show you that. I was always, a stay at home working mom even before the pandemic. Yeah. And they do the same thing.
Cool.
And it's, you know, it's something that you have to open your eyes and see it, but yeah, it's exactly the same. So I like that. I like joy, and I think we're going to end on that. We have about 2 minutes left, so let's just remind people.
Yeah, I'd love to plug some of the amazing artists in our Hudson Jazz Festival as we sign out. On October 3rd, we have Julius Rodriguez Group, incredible performer. The next night, Saturday, Katie George Quartet. And on Sunday, October 5th, Joel Ross's Good Vibes. Those are the headliner concerts at Hudson Hall. There are also all kinds of other activations through the city, at the Park Theater, at Second Ward Foundation, at the Caboose. And also, there's a program called Sounds Around Town, which has jazz artists in pocket parks by the train station. You never know where you're going to find them.
Like a little scavenger hunt of jazz.
Yeah, totally.
What a jazzy concept. I love it. Yeah, my daughter's in a jazz band at school. She's only in seventh grade, but yeah, it's very cute. I know. Yeah.
We went to see a jazz band at Avalon, and she leaned over to me in the middle of it and goes, "This is what our band is supposed to sound like." I was like, "Yeah, you got a little ways to go."
Well, she's self-aware. That's good.
Oh, yeah, completely. Completely. She's the best. Hey, Marianne. Anyway, so yeah, so that we're going to wrap it up right there. We got about 30 seconds left. So Adam, thank you so much.
Pleasure.
For coming and for having fun with my book of questions.
I love those questions. Yeah, great to be here. And please, yeah, do come visit.
Yeah.
See the art. Just say hi. We're there all the time.
Absolutely. So thank you so much. And again, that's hudsonhall.org. Thanks for listening.